Okay, it's a great honor to be in Australia. The English that I speak is a form of something you recognize. In the States, it's barely intelligible. But I've learned to speak Georgian. If I say dead instead of bed, that's my Georgian. When you're falling asleep, and I'll say, you do understand, don't you, that the dead are dead. Everybody smiles at me, but I shouldn't have done that so early, because you're not falling asleep yet. So we'll have to come up with something else when the time comes. I cannot imagine what I'm doing standing here wherever, I think this is Australia, Brisbane, yes, I see it. What am I doing here? I never set out to do anything like this. This is extraordinary. And it makes you feel that there's a God who is in charge of your career, you know. It really does, but I have no good reason for being here otherwise. So I'll tell you a little bit about my story. Now, what's the point of this? Not just a story, but I think that your young children, as you grow them up, you can learn some lessons from what we've been through and what you've been through. So there is a purpose to this. How to avoid some of the minefield pitfalls, right, that are out there in 35,000 denominations, I believe it is. 35,000. You know that Jesus said, I came to found one church, basically. And what was that? 1 Corinthians 1:10. I'll throw out a lot of verses, and you know these verses well. He says, Paul said here, I wish above all things, brothers and sisters, that you be all of one mind, perfectly joined in one judgment, right? 35,000 denominations all disagreeing? It doesn't sound right, does it? I'm a very naive and simple person, and that text impresses me. It's extraordinary. That's the ideal that Paul wanted. I don't think he expected everybody to have exactly everything in line, but you shouldn't have the degree of disagreement that we do have now with 1 billion Roman Catholics and Mormons and the rest of them. So the question is, how do you get millions of Mormons to believe, who are not more or less intelligent than you, how do you get them to believe that God has several wives and that God was a man before he became God? Did you know they believe that? They don't tell you that up front because it's a little bit shy of that, you know. So I said to the Mormon elder, he was 18, elder, I said, where do you find that in the Bible? And he hunted around for a while and he said, well, if we could find the lost books of the Bible, we would find. But it says, I thought, my dear young man, you're going to have to do better than that theologically to convince the public. But these people are not more or less intelligent than you. They're just as wholehearted. All right, so how then do you get 23 million Seventh-day Adventists to believe that all alcohol in the Bible, if it's positive, is grape juice? If it's bad scene, you know, with alcohol, it's got to be real alcohol. Their scholar, Bakayaki, has written a book to that effect, and it's one of the maddest things you can imagine. He's defending the system. He's defending what he's supposed to defend. But any child aged 12 can see that Jesus turned water into wine. But the Baptists don't understand that in the faith. So they did an equal miracle. They turned that wine into Welsh's grape juice, right? It's ridiculous, isn't it? I can make old people so angry, by the way, in the States by saying that. I would hardly dare say that in the South. Anyway, so religion is a problem. It's a minefield, obviously, isn't it? Now, it's easier to see the faults of others than yourself. So the lesson here is you turn the whole thing towards yourself. Then where in the world am I wrong? And you pray, if I may call it, the Dival prayer. Is Greg here, someone? Oh, he's there, right. There's the famous Dival prayer. It goes something like this. And I won't do the Australian accent, but I'll butcher it. So I can't even attempt to do it right. But, oh God, if I'm deceived, undeceive me. Got it? That's what you do, I don't know, three times a day, but at least some stages in your life. Send a kind person to tap me on the shoulder and suggest I might just adjust my thinking on this election. It's a good prayer. I suggest. Don't believe a word preachers say, check it out, right? You check your truth against my error. It never hurts to hear another point of view. You check your truth, strengthen your truth against my error, if that's what it is. And that's a good policy. So here we are with a variety of backgrounds. Actually fascinating, because mostly when people go to church, they isolate themselves from everybody else, don't they? You haven't got a clue what the guy down the road is learning. You're in your little church, all agreeing with your friends. But when you mix them, as we have done in this room here, it's an extraordinary thing. And you have to tread just a little carefully. See, I know your background, so I go easy on that one, and I can go strong on that one, and then back off a little. So it's an interesting exercise in diplomacy, so that we don't wind up killing each other over some hair of prophecy before we leave. Something like that. Anyway, our own experience. Let me just This is going to be a bit rambling. When I see you getting this marathon, you know, these conferences can be marathon-like. We're quick when you're getting tired. But this is my story. I'm just a frail little kid with blonde with blue eyes, you know, mother's firstborn, three children. And brought up in the C of E. Now, you know the C of E, don't you, and the SDAs, and you know the UPC, and you know the rest of them, all the acronyms, the CDs. That's not compact disc, that's Christadelphians, or as Americans mispronounce it, Christadelphians. No, Christadelphians, etc., etc., etc. You know all those acronyms. And the WWCG. The Worldwide Church of God of Armstrong, right? Of Armstrong. I'll tell you about that a little bit more in detail when we get to that. So I'm an innocent kid, I suppose, and you do know that in England, if your parents want you to have the best, quote, the best education, what do? They send you to a boarding school when you're 8. And for 2/3 of the year, for the rest of your career, till you're 18 and thereon, you don't get to see your parents. I think that's a mistake. We didn't do that with our children. But that's the system in England, and it's supposedly the, quote, best education. It means you don't understand women at all. It was a single-sex education. So when you go to university, as I did in America eventually, and I saw a girl in the classroom, I'm like, who are these people? You know, this is extraordinary. I haven't got a clue. I've been married for 38 years, so I'm doing better now. Anyway, so here I am, a prep schoolboy, preparatory schoolboy, with a grey suit, and a little grey cap, and a grey tie, and a grey shirt. Grey shorts, actually, clutching my school books under my arm, going to school, singing in the choir. That was pretty cool. Loved the choir, loved the music. And we had a sermon every morning of sorts in chapel. This is a huge chapel, 600 little boys from the age of 15 to 18. This is later than preparatory. I'll skip over the preparatory part. This is high school, what the Americans call high school, from 13 to 18. So you're there sitting among 600 boys, and I don't remember any subject that was preached in all those years. Except for one time when an American preacher arrived, and his name was the Reverend O'Heck. It really was. It really was, that's true. I think God has a sense of humor, and he armed me with that little story. It's dead true. And he got up in this raised pulpit, he climbed up the stairs and gazed down on the 600 little boys with their gray shirts and their gray ties, etc. And he said, and this is absolutely, I've remembered it, this is now what, this is 50, 60 years ago, more than that. I'm 73 now, so whatever that is. And he said, Samson was a strong man. Samson was a strong man, he said. I was riveted. I had never heard anybody speak English. This is in England, right? This American English just caught my ear. I have sort of ear for languages. And I was a language teacher, so that's what I do. It's the thing I can do with pleasure. And then he said that Samson had made an ice cream machine with cogs and wheels and whistles. And then he said, and did it work? No! The big voice boomed down the chapel. I've got a clue what the point of the sermon was. So I'm getting to my point here that I did not learn anything about the Bible at all. Now you guys are extraordinary. From this high you've been, you know, engaged in, well, what is this verse saying? I better get this one right because I might go to hell if I don't get it right. You're very nervous about some of this. Don't be quite so nervous. God doesn't smash you. Necessarily, if you've got one hair of prophecy wrong tonight, you know, didn't get it right till tomorrow or something. It's not quite that difficult, I think, although the way is narrow that leads to the kingdom of God. We do know that. So, I can't relate to any of that at all. We didn't discuss the Bible at home, but we did go to church on Sunday in the local church of England, where the church building has been there for 1,000 years, and the names of the clergy on the wall since 1066, literally, until 45, 50. So there I am with a complete note. Now, relate this to your own children. Don't let your children go into the world with a vacuum. Teach them properly, right? And I went into my sort of adult life in a vacuum. And that's dangerous. I didn't know anything. I couldn't have quoted you a verse. We did not discuss the Bible. I don't remember a single sermon. We didn't talk about scripture at all. Dad was a very honest man. He was director of naval intelligence. So life was about trying to figure out what's going on here. You know, the Russians have so many ships and the Egyptians have so many army soldiers and so on. So life is about trying to figure out what's going on in this chaos, right? And on my mother's side, they were all scholars and theologians writing books. And so you can see our DNA produces who we are. It's quite obvious who we are from the DNA. My parents loved each other, had a good family life. They adored their children. Sent me up to Oxford then to get, quote, the best education after I'd been through the high school experience there. And at Oxford University in 1956, way back, 1956, I was taken to a Get Saved meeting. I didn't know what that was, but a friend said, you've got to come and get saved. So I went. And after a lot of hype and a lot of emotional music and on and on and on and on, and I'm against it. When you repeat the same song as I heard 6 weeks ago, 50 times, you are inducing a sort of mesmeric situation. I don't think that one doctor was quite that bad. But anyway, at the end he said, come forward and get saved. I went back to my room and I said, what does this mean? What have I done here? What is this, get saved? But I began to read the Bible, and that was the beginning of a new life for me, totally, right? I began to read the Bible for the first time. I didn't understand it very well, but what I saw was what Paul was talking about. I saw this vision of the prophets, of a world where people don't kill each other, right? And that stays with me to this day. There's coming a world where if you build a tank, you're going to be stopped. If you threaten somebody else with a gun, you're going to be stopped. Of course, you're going to do the stopping, you know that. This world is not going to go on like this forever. I see that in the prophets. And somewhere in the back, there was a text which I read, and I remember writing it down, scribbling it down, back in 1956, where it says, the Torah goes out distorted. Habakkuk is bewailing the fact that the instruction never goes out straight. It's all crooked and bent. It's just a mess. And that struck me, because we got onto the argument of fighting and pacifism. My dad was working with the World Council of Churches. So at home we were discussing, can Christians kill each other, you know? Doesn't sound like a good idea, does it? By this shall all men recognize you as my disciples if you have love one for another. So I'm going to go and kill him in another country. I don't think so. Now that's a tough issue, I realize that. I don't want to be too controversial, but I became a sort of a conscientious objector type. And I'd been in the Navy for 2 years, national service, and I was blind, so they didn't let me steer the ship, but I worked at the pay role and that sort of thing. So I resigned my commission. I was a sub-lieutenant, as we say, S, bracket F, at secretarial branch. And Dad, of course, was rather horrified by that, although he was very generous and very sweet. He said, that, if you got to do that, son, that's okay. He was a very understanding person, wrote me nice letters at Oxford, said, you know, you have to do your thing. So there I am with a Bible. Now what am I going to do? Having discovered the prophets of Israel, who all said, they basically say two things. This is the key to reading the prophets. They say, it's a bad scene now, right? It's a mess. It's awfully bad. But wait, it's going to be wonderful. It's miserable, but it's going to be a new day coming. That's undoubtedly what the prophets of Israel say. There's coming a time of whining and dining. But now it's misery, whining with an H. And it's just a terrible situation. But it's going to change. That's basically what they all say. You know that. They reprimand Israel and the world for being awful. But the day is coming when the earth will be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. So I read that Isaiah 2 thing. You know, they're going to beat their swords into plowshares, and the nations will go up to Israel, to Jerusalem, and be taught instruction, Torah, if you like. Instruction. They'll be told how to do life right. That's a good idea, isn't it? Sounds good to me. So I read that, and then my life changed radically, because having got this glimpse of the Bible, which I'd never heard in church, never heard anything like that, and I'll just say this, and when I asked the clergy, and I'm not angry with the clergy, but I'm shocked in a way, when I would say to them, what do you understand by the second coming of Jesus, which I found in the New Testament, they said, that's the sermon I hate to preach on, because I've no idea what that is, and I don't like to preach it. I'm supposed to preach it once a year at Advent. I have no idea what that means, the clergy would say. Often very tall, distinguished clergy with a white dog collar, puffing on a pipe. And they look down at me and say rather patronizingly, lad, I've no idea what that's about, but whatever it is, I don't care to preach it. I was shocked at that. And then I would say, because I'd learned a bit of Bible by that time, reading a Moffat translation, I had just a Moffat translation, and I discovered this saying in the Beatitudes, which at school we couldn't even pronounce, we call it the Beatitudes, you know, we couldn't even pronounce those words. But the Beatitudes says, blessed are the meek, the sanftmütig, as the Germans say, the soft-mooted people, people with a gentle spirit, because they're going to have the earth as their inheritance. That's shocking. I never heard that in church. If I heard anything, it was that if I was a good boy, didn't kick the cat, was kind to Aunt Bessie, and so on, if I did good, then I would go to heaven and sit on a pink cloud and play a harp forever. Not even an orchestra of harps, actually solo clouds, mostly. I'm a musician, I'm a sort of a what should I say? I would have been an oboist in Korea, but thankfully God spared me from that. It's a very difficult thing to do professionally. So music, my brother's a professional pianist, so music was our thing. But orchestra is fun. One of the funniest things you can do in life is to play in an orchestra. It's marvelous. You're all going to do it, I'm sure, in the kingdom. So with that then, that text in Matthew 5:5, which we've used all over Africa, and we've been there several times, in Malawi, in Tanzania, and you tell these dear people, blessed are the meek, they're going to have the earth as their inheritance. This seems to be quite different from what I heard in church and what I hear on American TV and radio, right? Because if you hear anything at all, it is that when you die, you go straight to heaven to do who knows what, as a disembodied soul. No. How would you like to be disembodied? You wouldn't have any eyes or ears. You wouldn't be able to see anything, hear anything, feel anything. But no doubt it would be fun up there somewhere as a disembodied soul. That's Plato. That came from Plato and Greek philosophy. There's no question about that. Now, Plato also was into love of little boys. You know that. And when they translated Plato into English in the 1800s, for the Oxford and Cambridge people and all the big universities to read Plato, do you know what they did? Because that was embarrassing. Because Plato had the people he mentored, I mean, there was some sex involved in mentoring the boys, often. So when they came to those embarrassing parts, they just fudged the translation so the Victorians wouldn't have to face that. Isn't that amazing? And now you see what's happening. Plato is coming to full flower because homosexuality is not as bad as it was in Greece, probably, but that's amazing. And I think that the quote that Greg used, and I love that quote from Snape, you know, it's undoubtedly right. Many scholars know that Greek philosophy has interfered with the faith. And Jesus was a Jew. Yeshua, Jesus was a Jew, obviously. We know that. Yes, Mary was a Jew too. People don't seem to realize that. She was a Jew. And there's a Jew at the right hand of the Father right now, is there not? A glorified human being. None of which I knew anything about at that stage in the game. So here comes then the next event. And again, this does have an application to you and your young ones as you bring them up. Here comes the cult. Beware the cult. The cult is this. The cult says, you don't read anything except what we teach you, and our tradition is, and our founder was so-and-so, and he got it all right, and you're nodding, and now you invest the family in this, and your children, and then you're caught. You are no longer critical in the best sense. Very difficult. And let me say what I've observed on the internet with thousands and thousands of exchanges by email, is that once you get it wrong, it's going to take two or three generations to get it right, possibly, unless you're very bright and intelligent and are really free. It's not easy to change denominations. It's very hard to change if you had beloved teachers, Sunday school teachers and pastors who taught you a certain way, that's deeply invested in you. Perhaps I had some advantage there because I didn't have any real training at all for 20 years. I didn't know anything about anything. Or as they say in Georgia, didn't know nothing about nothing at all. Really had almost a blank slate. Now that's not good either. And my father regretted later when he said, I wish I'd taught you some good theology and you wouldn't have fallen for, which is the next chapter in my story. The Herbert W. Armstrong phenomenon, right? One of the more wicked phenomena of our time, let me tell you. I want to say that religion is a wicked thing, much worse than many of you imagine. Now there are good people, of course, in it. But theologically it's inept. Amateur, terribly amateur, and the cult says, don't you read any books, don't you get the word biblical commentary, state of the art and evangelical theology, don't read that, you just read what we write. And into that vacuum of my ignorance came that thundering voice of Herbert W. Armstrong. Guess what? He copied from the Church of God Seventh Day the stuff about the kingdom. And to that I could relate. I heard that thing, I said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I see their kingdom when they're going to beat their swords into plowshares, and the nations are not going to learn war anymore, and the West Points, and what's the other place where they train soldiers, the West Points and the other place, are going to be curio museums in that day. Look back at it. You mean we actually trained people? Blood makes the grass grow. Kill, kill, kill. We trained people to slaughter each other. And we'll say, what in the world were we doing? So Herbert then said, the kingdom is coming. And that sounded good, because I'll tell you one thing, it's unarguable. If you want to show your friends, or show yourself this very night, if you're not familiar with this, open any Bible, any translation will do, open to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you will find, and this is unarguable, that the kingdom of God, the Vasilia tou Theou, and I'm using the modern Greek pronunciation, I say this at the table, not mangling my Greek, because we've chosen to teach it as a modern language, the Vasilia tou Theou, the Malchut Shamayim, the kingdom of the heavens, is what Jesus was all about. isn't it? How do I know that? Luke 4:43, that's a refrigerator verse, right? You know, things you pin up on your fridge to remind you. My God is love. The Lord is my shepherd. And most of you don't put up God is a consuming fire, do you? You're very selective. Only the Pollyanna verses, you know, the nice ones, the happy text. But that's a great verse. Luke 4:43, the parallel in Mark 1:38. Don't read it in the King James, I say with trepidation, but the King James is a museum piece. You don't talk to your children really that way. It puts a fog over their minds. It can. Beautiful language, yes. Marvelous poetry, yes. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I want to tell you that, I got it wrong there. Verily I say unto you, probably something like that, that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. That's all right. But the these and the thous, and some of these words are just impossible for children, and they put a sort of a churchy fog over your mind. I would recommend you use the New American Standard Version, the Roman Catholic Bible, NAB, very nice. The NIV, the nearly inspired version, I would avoid. Because it's simply wrong. And as I get, I'm throwing this in, but in 16:28 of John, and 13:3 of John, and 20:17 of John, it says, Jesus has said that he was going back to the Father. You say it. Check your Greek. It's false. It promotes the idea of a pre-existent Jesus. And in Philippians 2, it says something about being in very nature God. That's Jesus. So he's God, right? Being God in very nature. That's false. That's just wrong. So the NIV is to be avoided. But a lot of it reads beautifully, too. And there's lots of good stuff in all translations. So armed then with the Bible, Herbert Armstrong then said, the kingdom is coming. And that's undoubtedly unarguable. And Steve Cook did this so nicely this morning. I hope you were here. He pointed out that Jesus, I'm throwing the theology into the story, to sort of mix these things up a bit, but he pointed out that Jesus preached the gospel, not just the good news. The NIV very cleverly says, look at the trickery here. The NIV says, he only preached the good news, not the gospel. False. Jesus preached Evangelion, the gospel. Isn't that clever? Paul preached the gospels in the NIV, and Jesus only preached the good news. Just tell the story. That's a brilliant point. That's a conversation stopper around your coffee table. No, Jesus preached the gospel about the kingdom of God, right? And this particularly gets the interest of Christadelphian people, because they did this so well. This part of Christadelphianism was done so well, I would say. And you know, the point that Steve made is really good. By the way, all of this preaching and teaching is for you to do. You know that. I see the exercise that we do in these conferences. So you go home and you use some of these verses, and then you do it through your own grid. You don't just copy, but through your own grid, your own experience, you use this method. Like a Chopin prelude, you've got the same notes that you've got in the music, but you can play it a million different ways, right? Through your personality. But these are the sort of things you can point out to people who don't know anything about the Bible. Luke 4:43. That's a great place to start, because there, the situation was in Capernaum that they felt that Jesus was a good rabbi. They said, stay around, Rabbi Yeshua. We like your teaching. You're a lot more solid than a lot of the preaching we hear from the Pharisees. Stay around. We'll have you as our resident rabbi. And what did he say in response? I must. I'm duty bound. I'm theologically driven to preach the good news, the gospel, about the kingdom of God. That's the reason for which I was sent. I would avoid the King James. Thereunto am I sent. I wouldn't do that. You're putting people into a sort of, oh, what's that about? No, that's the reason why God commissioned me and you and everybody, presumably the body of Christ is supposed to do the same thing, to announce the coming kingdom. So Herbert then got me. Herbert Armstrong got me. And here's how he got me. I could see that salvation involves obedience to Jesus. Doesn't it? Or can you shake your fist in Jesus' face and pretend to be saved? I don't think so. Salvation is given to those who obey him. And obviously, you're supposed to do what Jesus says. And there's a text in Luke 6 where he says, why do you say to me, Lord, Lord, but you will not do what I say? And that got to my little frail heart. You know, I was an admiral's son, and when Dad said we do it, we did it. So that sort of saying got to me. Now comes the cult. Watch this. Have you read the Ten Commandments recently, Anthony? Well, I hadn't. I hadn't. Probably couldn't have found them. But that fourth commandment says to rest on the Sabbath, on Saturday. You going to do it? And I'm nodding. It cost me 14 years of very great trouble in many ways. Now, it was less difficult for some people outside the main college where I was stationed in California. But I was a Sabbath keeper, and I was going to do that because God said, keep the Sabbath. I may step on some toes here, but I would want to argue that Paul has a slightly different idea then. So now I'm a Sabbath keeper, and Dad used to say, well, this is chicken feed, you know, chicken feed, he said, whether you rest on Sunday or Saturday. It's really not the main issue, because I think he was right, but I was too stupid to understand it at that point. I was ignorant. Into the vacuum of my ignorance came this thundering voice. Now, you may say, well, this is just a minor thing. It's not. If you start keeping the Sabbath in England at that age, you are now desocialized. You can't go to weddings on Saturday. You're off with the cult. And I was. It's major desocialization from your natural family. Now, you can argue that Jesus requires us to give up family. You can. I don't think, though, on that point. So I've written a booklet on that, if you're interested in following. If you have any friends who are involved in that, it's the law of the Sabbath and new covenant. And I've worked it as hard as I can, and you may detect errors in it, but I've, for me, a catharsis that you are free in the New Testament. Not free to do exactly what you want to do, obviously, but I will remind you that Paul said, let nobody judge you in three areas, Sabbath, holy days, and new moons. They're a trio, which are one single shadow. They all stand and fall together. Now, if you want to observe the new moons, that's fine. It doesn't necessarily impress your neighbor to watch you gazing at the moon, whatever you might do. And I meet people say, well, we're keeping the new moons now, and this is really, I'm getting so close to God. Maybe they are, but remember the world out there. Are you going to go and teach those Africans to observe the new moons? You know, it has implications beyond what is good for you. So that I think I understand now, but I didn't then. So I was into Sabbath keeping and holy day keeping, and we kept it faithfully. And we paid three tithes, right? Not one tithe, not one tenth of gross income, but three tenths of gross income were designated. First tenth went to Herbert and the Empire, and the second tenth was for keeping the feast. So we blew, or spent, one tenth of our income in 1 week at the Feast of Tabernacles. Wasn't always a good idea, because people got, somebody said wasted, I heard that word. Wasted, that's a great, great term, you know what I mean. Spending all that money in 1 week, right? And then the third tithe was for the poor Levites, every third year. And I'm not quite sure where it wound up, but that was our tithing system. And that was taken out of our salaries when I worked in the college. My dear friend Gordon Graham here will remember some of that. We called him, by the way, Monsieur Le Grand. I was a French teacher. My first degree is in foreign language. The language is the thing I found easy to do. Hopeless in geography. Worse in history. Terrible in science. I mean, this fellow would be appalled to know what I don't understand about chemistry. Practically nothing. But language I could do. That was fun. Playing with words was fun. So when I met him at Ambassador College, because I went to Ambassador College then in California, I said, I'm leaving Oxford, I'm going to go out there. And something of sanity prevailed, and I finished my degree at Oxford. And thank the Lord I did, because later it enabled me to earn a living when we came out of the Armstrong room. So this is 14 years of my life, right? And it didn't work for me. I didn't know why it didn't work, but it nearly destroyed me. I could not survive in that Californian atmosphere. But we had the Sabbath. We had the sign of God's people. Yes, we had the sign of the Old Covenant, Exodus 31. Yes, we did. But be careful not to mix the covenants entirely. It's a tricky issue. Paul is both pro-law and anti-law. And he's pro-law in the spirit and I think anti-enforced law in the letter. That's what I've learned now, but I didn't know any of that then. So here I am going off to California. My dad is terribly distressed. You know, poor old dad, wanting the best for his son, and this Anthony, and it falls for this not well-educated American salesman with a thundering voice. But that's what happens. So God is in all of this, by the way, you know that. He uses these events to fashion our lives and then give us a kind of a sympathy and empathy for other people who go through the same thing. I think that's how it works. So that was 14 years. It didn't work for me. I always found in Ambassador College in California, in Pasadena. And this was American to me. I mean, this is American. Strange American people. Very foreign to my British heritage. So I struggled through my courses down there, got my Bachelor of Arts in that college. I was not happy at all. It was very tough, very hard. And I didn't know why, because I always found that people outside the movement, I could somehow talk to them. They seemed to be normal. But those on the inside were somehow abnormal. I don't know what that was, but I noticed that. And there were good people there, of course. But we were keeping God's Sabbath, and you pagans were resting on Sunday. Witchcraft! Come on now. I was told within the last 6 weeks by a very dedicated lady that we were into witchcraft because we were actually meeting on a Sunday. And that was the person who'd been out of Armstrong for 30 years. But what? The arm of the guru is still around her neck. Listen carefully. If you have been indoctrinated, it's going to take sometimes a long time, spiritual surgery, to have a rethink. Take a deep breath and say, maybe I should pray the Bible prayer and hope that somebody will send me a good person to tap me on the shoulder. You might want to look at this part of your system. Okay, so moving quickly on. 14 years later, this time I'd moved to the Ambassador College in Great Britain. It was a beautiful campus. For Gordon, I met Gordon there. They had with all that money, you know, can afford to have a nice campus. It was a gorgeous place, like the Garden of Eden restored, practically. But the theology was rotten, and some of the lifestyle was rotten. I won't go into all the detail, but it was emerging at that point that the lifestyle of the leadership was not good. But then I got married, and I became more sane. You may not think I'm very sane now, but I was a lot worse off before I got married. So Barbara showed up as a student in the French class, the blonde in the front row, and I was the teacher. My hands were shaking. I couldn't write on the board. So I married a student. And she's over there. Shouldn't tell these embarrassing stories, should you? But and you gain a sort of stability and sanity. And I did. We were married by Herbert Armstrong, by the way. And we had his Rolls Royce. He had a Rolls Royce that was better than the Queen's. He did. It had a fitting that the Queen did not have in her Rolls Royce. And we were driven with his chauffeur down to the reception. That was in 1917. So that was now an extraordinary theological chapter. And I'd learned much from the Bible. I mean, we did study the Bible. I'd become, I suppose, reasonably familiar with the Bible. I never preached a sermon. I taught some Hebrew. They sent me to Jerusalem, and I learned some Hebrew at Jerusalem University. And I taught French, and I directed the choir. Not very well, I think, but I didn't preach a sermon. I was spared from enforcing that very wrong theological system, as I now think. So here we are then at the end of it, and we discovered then that the system was wrong. The guru fell. Here's how the guru will fall, should any of your children ever get into this, or if you've ever come under a similar situation. The guru fell in two ways. First, doctrinally. Herbert Armstrong said, you cannot be born again now. You've got to wait till the resurrection to be born again. It's wrong. Peter said, having been born again now, desire the milk of the word. Is that clear? We didn't understand that. Having been born again now, that's in 1 Peter, you're desiring the milk of the word. You're not a fetus waiting to be born in the future. You're desiring the milk of the word. This is easy. And evangelicals understood that well, but we didn't. And the cult, you know, will have its special doctrines. I think in business, Paul would probably tell me, in business, you want to have some special thing that nobody else has got, right? There's a term for that. Well, if you think that there are two thieves either side of Jesus, not one thief, or if you think that, and you've died for this, that the resurrection was on Saturday and the crucifixion was on Wednesday, you've got an edge, as you think. I think that's false, by the way. But you've got an edge on other people. And we did that rather well in Armstrong. So that born-again thing failed. They used the text in John where it says, the man who's born again is like the wind, you see. So we said, if you're born again, you'd be like the wind. We were very amateur, may I say. Very, very bad. And I want to tell you that the Academy, with all of its faults, by that I mean the best scholarship in the Roman Catholic and the Protestant Church, is some kind of balance. Because everything I believe today, I could demonstrate from a standard dictionary. And some of the quotes that Greg wrote this morning, read this morning, are really astonishing. If you stop and ponder. Because they're conceding many of the things that you and I believe. So the Academy has its place. It really does. The Strong's Concordance is not necessarily adequate to do all of your work. I know it's difficult. You don't have access to libraries. I know that's difficult. But I see the guru playing on ignorance. And I hear this, for instance. Okay, if you've got italicized words in the Bible, that means they aren't part of the original, so you can just remove them. False. Sometimes in language you require an extra word to make sense, right? Or I hear, well, pneuma, that's pneuma, or pneuma, is neuter in Greek, so it couldn't be a person. That's also false, because sexual gender and grammatical gender are not the same thing. There are lots of tricks. Now look at the contemporary time where you have the word echad, one, right? And on our JesusIsHuman.com free video at the website, JesusIsHuman.com, we've got a rabbi at the beginning saying, well, I know what echad means, he said. Echad means one. Now you can call a table a chair if you like, it's a free world. But echad means one, and he's right. Meanwhile, the evangelical messianics are telling us that echad is really compound one. So you go in a dollar store where everything's $1, you can't come up to pay for it, and the lady at the cashier's register, that's $13, compound one. I want to tell you that religion is mad. It is a mad thing. It is. I don't think I'm overstating that. I'm not saying there aren't wonderful people. There are wonderful people everywhere. But some of the stuff you get taught is so bad. Like God has several wives, and God was a man before he became God, and so on. It's pathetically bad, especially when Jewish people really perjure themselves and say that echad means more than one. I mean, that's really bad. Check with your lexicons, check with your rabbis. They know what echad means. It means one. I mean, if I said to you that one really means black and white in the phrase one zebra, or is it zebra in this part of the world? I don't know. Whatever that is. One zebra, okay? So that proves that one means black and white. Got it? You're bleeding the meaning of the zebra, black and white, into the one, and that's what they're doing, you see? So one team, although you have many members of the team, it doesn't prove that one means more than one. So one team, not two teams, right? One family, not two in two families. It's easy. But the devil, I want to tell you, however you define that, is very smart. And he knows that we in America particularly are not very good when it comes to words. We're easily taken. And his propaganda machine works, as I think, to deceive people. And as Frank was saying today, this is no small deal, who God is, right? It's no small deal. You think that if you love Jesus, you might want to bother with his creed. I don't think there's ever been a meeting, at least recently, where somebody said, let's talk about the creed of Jesus. I've asked Christian friends, you know, Bible-believing people, I said, have you ever thought about the creed of Jesus? And they said, oh, no. No, why would I? We know what the creed is. Or you say, was Jesus a Trinitarian? Agreeing with a Jewish scribe. Now, if they say, yes, of course he was. Well, you're telling me that this Jewish scribe believes in the Trinity, and that's not very good. And if the Jewish scribe was a Unitarian, and Jesus said, you got it right, then Jesus is affirming a Unitarian creed, isn't he? So one leading ministry in America said, well, actually, Jesus had one finger up in front and three fingers behind his back. They said that. I want to tell you that the human mind will construct the most idiotic excuses to avoid the truth if it wants to. It's true. And I use this little story with my sister, younger sister, 10 years younger than I, and when Nanny said, Nanny would be, not grandmother, but Nanny would be the nanny who worked, you know, with the children. And Nanny said, you go out and play in what we call the yard in America, the garden in England. Go out and play in the garden. And my sister came back. And Nanny said, I told you to go in the garden, get out there and play. And Jill said, I hope she won't hold this against me. She said, a blackbird nearly kicked me. In other words, you will, believe me, our little minds are very crooked if we want to avoid the truth. And so to say that echad means more than one is really an extraordinary thing. I think we're going to be vindicated for what we're saying. I think one day Jesus will say to the whole world, come on folks, echad means one. So watch that rabbi on our JesusIsHuman.com. It's beautiful. He sits there very sweet, very mild. A free world, you know, tables and chairs, sure. But I know that echad means one, and I think it is right. Now, if that's right, in a sense, the whole of church history has to be reconstructed, doesn't it? Because this thing they call the church has got the doctrine of God somehow wrong. Now, how God assesses all this, judge, I'll leave that to him. Shall not the judge of the world do right, say the CDs? Good text. Very good. God will deal with all that. So we don't go around saying, well, we know all X's are lost. We know all certain numbers. We know they're all... Don't, even if you knew it, don't say it. I don't know it at all. Somehow God, through Jesus, will sort all this out. So here we are then coming out of Armstrong because the sexual misdemeanors at the top were becoming public information. And I won't detail all that because it's all been done by Time magazine. You don't want to even bother that. But some of these movements, like the Way International, also at the top, corrupt. And I will mention this, that if, as a leader of a group, you counsel your counselee women into sex, you're doing worse than an atheist by far. Is it clear? Because people will say, oh, but he taught me the Bible, I got working the Word, and I learned this and I learned that. Yes, but the man is a disaster if he's going to do that kind of thing. And they pay a penalty for that. Because this one guru said, you should not be water baptized. That's wrong. You only should be baptized in spirit. Never get water baptized. And the same guru wrote, and I quote, in the book of Acts, baptism and water are never connected. Amazing, isn't it? You can get away with, as we say in England, bloody murder. You can get away with murder if you say it loud enough and long enough. And people are nodding because they think you're the guru or the apostle dropped from heaven 6 months in a prayer closet and so on. I don't think we have apostles like the 12 today, actually. If we do, we better all obey them. Yes, you could have a missionary apostle. I don't like the term because people think they're the two witnesses. There are already six witnesses. There are two in Australia. There are six two witnesses. Did you know that? So I would avoid some of these grandiose titles and just be, you know, just who you are. Okay, so that's the Herbert Armstrong thing finished for us. A number of you here had experiences similar to that, but not quite as intense as we did. We come out, now we say, what are we going to do for church now, right? So by this time I was married, I was 34 years old, and we are in England by this time, and buying our first house, you know how that goes. And now where do you go to church? I think we were atheists for 3 weeks. Our whole life had crumbled, right? The guru had fallen, our idol had fallen, and you say, well, where's God in all this? You're shattered. And so then you say, what do I do next? I think, as I said, we were atheists. We had about 2 car accidents in the space of 2 weeks. It seemed like, I don't know if God was getting our attention, it seemed like that. But we pulled ourselves together and we said, let's start all over again and see if we can see where we went wrong. But we had learned the doctrine of the sleep of the dead, that beautiful thing called conditional immortality, that teaches that the dead are dead. What part of the word dead don't you understand? Jesus said, Lazarus is asleep, he's dead, I'm going to wake him up. End of story. No, no. You're not going to get away with it so easily. Or better still, I'm throwing you these beautiful texts. I've taught in the Bible, in this Bible college last, you know, I'm retired now really, but when you do this as a job, I was saying before, you gain a certain facility. I mean, unless you're stupid, you know, if you're doing it as a job, you're going to see these things over and over again. So Daniel 12:2 is a wonderful text, you know that one. Many of those who are sleeping in, what's the Hebrew there? Afar, the dust, Admat Afar, they go. Admat Afar, the dust land, are going to wake up. That tells you what they're doing and where they're doing it, doesn't it? Sleeping, where? In the dust. Is that difficult? Not until Plato comes along. Then it gets very difficult. So we have time, I'll tell you a little clip from N.T. Wright, which Greg mentioned this morning. And N.T. Wright is coming on board with us in some of this, but he's still, from my angle, rightly or wrongly, confused, because he says we have life after death. You got it? When you die, you're still alive in some sense, but then you get life after death. That's too complicated for me. Jesus didn't say Lazarus is alive, he said he's dead and sleeping. So Daniel 12:2, this is what you do for your friends. Now, again, I'm assuming you're all going to take these texts, and you've got 6 billion human beings on the face of the earth who absolutely have to understand that God is one eventually. So get busy. You haven't got a lack of fish to go fishing for. Use the website, whatever you can reasonably do, and convince somebody that when you're dead, you're actually dead. It's a beautiful text. Because then all your eggs are in the resurrection basket. Now we're talking, right? Now it's getting clear. So when Christ comes back, the parousia, the arrival of the king to take over his territory, the dead are going to be raised. That's 1 Corinthians 15:23. Those who are in Christ, who are Christians, are going to be raised at his second coming. So what are they doing before that? Sleeping. The children love that. Easy. I love that. And Daniel 12:2 is easy because it says, those who wake up in the resurrection from the Admat Afar, from the dust land, are going to wake up to the life of the age, the Chaye Olam. When you do Hebrew, by the way, people in the front row need an umbrella because there's always a lot of stick going on. The Chaye Olam. That means the life of the age. And the rabbis, of course, were smart enough to see that means the life of the age to come. Oh, wonderful. I saw that. Ah, beautiful. 40 times in the New Testament you've got eternal life. Poor translation. Better, the life of the age to come. So you can always render safely the eternal life as, or everlasting life, as the life of the age to come. Straight out of Daniel 12, verse 2. And people should know that, because you know the piece called Fiddler on the Roof. What did they sing at the wedding when they got slightly intoxicated and jumped on the tables and bounced around on the table? They sang, to life, l'chaim, 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 to life. Are you too young or old or something to know that? I don't know how that works, but beautiful. That's the Hebrew word for life. So you and I then are in the life business, the immortality business. Jesus was in the immortality business, not selling anything. But he was saying to the public, how would you like to live forever? Does that sound like an interesting proposition? That's what he's saying. How would you like to have the Chaye Olam, the life of the age to come, I think. And he brought immortality and life to light through the gospel. So then the gospel has to be very important. Here we are then. What are we going to do? Herbert had failed us, right? We began looking at the Sabbath in the law in great detail, poring over the commentaries, poring over the Greek. And you know how God can compensate you sometimes when things are really bad? He'll bring something good. And I got a modest job at the American School in London, where they were paying us an American rate. Very nice conditions. And I was teaching German and French there for 7 years. But I was really much more interested in the Greek New Testament and the Hebrew Old Testament. So I was reading my Greek interlinear in the tube train going in, the tube train coming out, day after day. And trying to figure out where we'd gone wrong. And I always came back to the kingdom. I could see that's the center of it. And the sleep of the dead seemed to be right. So we hung on to that. Now, with those doctrines, where are you going to go to church in England? We hadn't got to the Trinity thing by that time. You don't have the same smorgasbord of churches in England as you do in America. You know that. In America, if it isn't McDonald's, it's a church. You know that. Huge number of people. Whereas in England, people are not going to church very much. You don't have that choice. And if you are a typical Londoner, where you get, 98% of people don't go to church except to be hatched, matched, and batched. That's just a fact. You don't have the same choice. You go to a Baptist church, a Methodist church, maybe a Pentecostal church, and that's it. Or the CV, the Church of England. But the Christadelphians were there. Harry Temple. And so I owe him a lot, in a way. We said, well, we've got this kingdom. The kingdom part seems to be right. That seems to be right. So what are we going to do? Nobody understood the kingdom except the CDs, really. So we went to the CDs and they said, you're not supposed to know about the kingdom, only we know about it. Oh, no, we understand the kingdom. On the other hand, since you believe in the devil, you cannot have fellowship with us. So, well, that was a little disappointing, but they were very decent with it, too. And I respect that. I don't believe it's right, but I respect it. So for 2 years, and this is interesting. Again, I hope this bears on your own experience. And that's what I'm directing this to. It's not just for me. It's for you and your children. For 2 years, and we were shattered. You know, when your guru falls, you are really shattered. You're really open. You say, oh God, you do the Bible prayer. Let me try to get this right second time round. Because you're really shattered. You barely believe in God. You struggle back to faith. And the Christadelphians came to our house every Thursday, and our girls were probably 4 and 2 years old, maybe 6 and 4 years old. So the eldest one there, Sarah. And she will remember this. Harry Tennant came in, and very sweetly, I think, very kindly, he said, you got a couple of things completely wrong, Auntie. First is your Son of God stuff. You know, you think the Son pre-existed. We were binatarians. Two gods in the God family. That's what Herbert said. And I hadn't thought about it, but that's what we really believe. He said, that's wrong. Jesus did not pre-exist at birth. And now, for me, that's the most beautiful truth there is. I'd love to take half an hour and do Luke 1, but next time I get a chance, I'll go through Luke 1. I'm just singing. I'm ecstatic. It's beautiful stuff. But I didn't understand any of that. And I had all the answers. And this is you again. If somebody comes, believe me, with a point of view that you're not used to, your natural action is going to be bristling. And mine was. Listen, it says in 1 Corinthians 10 that the rock that followed them was Christ, doesn't it? Well, don't tell me Christ wasn't there. It says the rock that followed them. You can see that rock walking along, can't you? And this dear CD, I remember these are defining moments. This dear CD said to me, that's a figure of speech, it's a typical language, typology. Ah, he's explaining the way, was my reaction. I was a fool. The more you can admit and say, I was scammed, the better off you are. Don't say, well, no. No, you were wrong. You were wrong, you were scammed, you were stupid. I was. I shouldn't have gone in the Armstrong movement, really. But God allows this and he can use it for us. So we worked through that for 2 years. They came every Thursday. And then they did say, well, you've got this devil thing wrong. I said, well, sure, I mean, we probably have. I mean, maybe we misread all of that, too. The Satan devil thing. Now I'm really getting edgy. You know, some of you are getting terribly worried here. I know that. But after 2 years, I'll have to say, and we did try very hard, we were not able to get rid of the devil. We talked about the demons and so on and so on and so on. We really tried hard. And Harry and I then parted company as good friends, but we just had to agree to disagree. It was like I was looking at a picture and I saw, let's say, a tree in the picture, and he saw a lion. We were not seeing this alike. And I will, you know, if I had 2 hours, I would give you all I could, but I don't want to do that because you won't sleep well tonight. So there we are now then with still a belief in the devil, so we couldn't be in fellowship with the CDs, and I respected that, and they were drawing the line. And we got the kingdom. We got sleep of the dead, so we go to the Church of England, red carpet treatment, you know, come along in. And you get a 10-minute sermon on going to heaven. And you say, oh no, that doesn't sound right. We tried the Baptists, and we tried the Methodists, and we tried everybody. The Pentecostals, and they were there ready to push us over. I'm against slaying the Spirit, I'll say that to you frankly, I'm against it. I do not believe that. Typical, but I probably shouldn't say it. Yes, Pentecostal is wonderful. I mean, the Spirit is everything, isn't it? But I wasn't impressed with some of what I saw in England. There were gold fillings in the tea, and glitter coming on people, and all sorts of... That didn't impress me at that point. I may be wrong. Maybe wrong. So now where are we going to go to church? It's almost impossible, right? We went to Bible studies, and the moment we said we thought the dead were not in heaven, we were marginalized. They could see they were getting uneasy, and we were sort of asked not to come back. I've got letters in the file which say, you and Barbara are good people, you're not abrasive, you're fairly kind and reasonable, but we really don't want you. And then the Plymouth Brethren were there, and we had communion service with them, and Harry Tennant had got to me on the Trinity thing by this time. I was rejoicing in that. That God is actually one, that Jesus is the human Messiah, beautiful stuff. And when I said to these Plymouth Brethren, we actually don't believe in the Trinity, they walked out in the middle of the service. They did. I respect it. That's the point of view. So now you say, dear God, what is this? We aren't popular anywhere with these beliefs. Christians won't have us. Nobody will have us. And we did, again, I think we did the Bible prayer in a slightly different form. We said, oh God, we've got the rest of our lives. We were probably 45 years old. I was by that time, 45. What are we going to do for the rest of our careers? I had this job at the American School for 7 years. Nice, but I was interested in the theology. And the German and the French have been a huge blessing for me because I read a lot of stuff in German, and the Germans are marvelous theologians. The French Catholics have written beautiful stuff on the Bible. It's been very useful. And I'll draw this to a close, it's going to get late for you and long, but we're now saying, where are we going to go? And so after, this was a 7-year period, and finished at the American School, they kept the job open for us, for me, and they said, you can come back next year. We said, we're going to the USA. We'll see what's over there. Armed with our doctrinal package that nobody in England found acceptable, really. Arrived in America, the only people we knew were the Christadelphians. We'd go on the beach with them, talk to them, and argue about the devil sometimes. And then I said, is there anything like the Christadelphians, perhaps? Is there any group that's even religious? And they're so well hidden in the cornfields of Illinois. The Church of God, of the faith of Abraham since 1850, cousins to the CDs, really. And they were there in a tiny Bible college. So one Friday, I remember phoning the president of the college, and I said, do you believe in the devil, externally? He said, yes. I knew we were home. We were home. And we went up there and went to church with 200 people, and I couldn't believe it. All those people believed the dead were dead. They believed that God was one, that the kingdom was coming. I couldn't believe it, because we hadn't found anybody. That's amazing. So then taught in that college for 28 years. That started in 1981, 82, and had small classes, a lot of time to read, and they sent me to get a degree at a Brethren college. That was a Church of God of the Brethren. They're the Mennonite people. And they called me the friendly heretic and let me kind of do my thing and get my degree. So that was wonderful. And that's been a blessing. So then it's gone on until internet, and that has changed your world, hasn't it? It used to be in the 1980s that one person per year from Peru or Nicaragua or something like that would write and say, what you're doing is interesting, send me booklets, and we'd send out literature. Now it's 3 or 4 people a day even, brand new people from all over the world. You know this. So it's changed. And let me just sort of finish with this and say that religion has been hell along the way for us. I mean, really awful. So if you're going through a bad time, don't forget Acts 14:22. Through much tribulation, we enter the KG. The kingdom of God. But it's come out well for us. We actually have a very pleasant experience in church now. We have a small church in Fayetteville, and the Church of God people have been very good to us, and we've traveled and been able to do things and meet amazing folk like yourselves. I just mentioned this when we went to New Zealand last time, just been there one time. That was like going to meet one's relatives, because they're so like the Brits. And we sat down after dinner and did a Bible study. I never had done that in England. You don't do Bible study in England, nobody does that. They wouldn't know what to do with it. But in New Zealand, these people were willing to discuss the Bible. That was an extraordinary experience. So there we are. And then eventually, of course, I met Greg there, and that was an extraordinary experience looking back on it. God's workings are kind of invisible. I mean, for me, I don't get a flashing light necessarily, a voice booming in my ear. But as I look back and I see things happening, people moving around, and even in the teaching situation, people will come up and ask a question. It's just the right one. The Spirit is moving and guiding. I see that. And that night, I think, when Gordon invited us to that Bible study, and Greg was there, and I remember so well that when we walked in and met Greg for the first time, he said to me, I know you don't believe in the Trinity, because I think we'd probably written that book by that time. But we'll not argue about that, certainly. So we talked about everything else and found that he believed in the premillennial kingdom. I'll die a premillennialist. You won't talk me out of the millennium. I think that's a secure doctrine. And so we had a nice time until midnight, everybody went away. And I wasn't planning anything. God, I think, was working for us all here. And I said to Greg, why do you believe in the Trinity? Because he's such an expert Bible student. And the Trinity made no sense to me at that stage. And the rest is his book, you know, it's amazing. So eventually then he came over to Atlanta. And you wind up meeting all sorts of interesting people. So that's the story. I hope again, I'm not just telling you this for my own story, although it's fun to tell your story. People like stories. But I think there's an application for you somewhere here. Don't let your children suffer the vacuum effect, right? Because the cults are out there, and they'll get you. You don't want that. You don't want them to be so legalized that they rebel against religion. That's the other thing. If you make life so difficult for them and make them nervous, you know, then they're going to fight you and rebel against that. You give them this, what I would call, I hope that we can give to our next generation, a sort of kinder, gentler form of the faith. Rather easy. God actually is one, the God of Israel. And then there's a son that Mary had a baby and produced by virginal begetting, by miracle, a son. He's a Messiah. That means he's going to rule the world. If you're a Messiah, you're going to rule the world, right? And you're being recruited to rule the world with him. So you're the royal family I'm looking at now in training. And so in 1 Corinthians 6:2, in the Moffat translation, Paul says, don't you know the saints are going to manage the world? So what sort of people should you be now, right? Do we want adulterers managing the world in the future government? I don't think so. So straighten out, he says, right? How dare you take each other to court right now? Don't you know? For Paul, this is real. In other words, the future is driving the ethics, isn't it? The lifestyle now is being driven by your royal appointment. You are the kings and queens. You are the aristocracy of tomorrow's coming age, as I understand it. It's quite an honor, isn't it? So you are the trainee royal family. So what kind of people should we be? I think Paul would say that sort of thing. That's where I am today. Now, you may want to come up after and say, straighten me out on this or whatever. You may. Take it slowly, because when you're this old, you know, when you're in your 70s, you don't change quite that quickly. But that seems to be the faith. God, Jesus, the kingdom of God gospel, and straight, particularly in areas of sexual purity, a straight life. Very important. Because I've seen people ruin their careers by having children out of wedlock, etc., etc., etc. I mean, it's just a mess. So those things are very important. But whether you have shrimp for supper or not is not an issue for me. You want to have some wine with your supper, that's wonderful. If you want it, you don't, that's fine too. But in religion, they will argue about some of these non-essentials sometimes. That's not good. So that's basically what I understand. And I do thank you for allowing me to tell the story. I'll get some other things next time. Thank you.